Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Craig's latest Florida Phoenix column, FloridaPhoenix.com, introduces probably many people for the first time to the acronym ESG. Craig, what is ESG?
Well, it's the latest boogeyman that's being dangled about by our Florida politicians, particularly our chief financial officer, Jimmy Patronis, and the governor are ranting about how awful ESG is. Oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. It's companies that are taking into account environmental, social, and governmental guidance issues in their investing. So in other words, if you have a company that has some money to invest, or a local government with money to invest, and you look around and you find a company that would take that investment that is considering their impact on, say, climate change, these folks are saying, oh, you can't do that. You can't invest in these companies that are worried about climate change. You have to invest in companies that don't care whatsoever about their impact on the world. And it's kooky. And the reason I wrote about it is because Patronis in particular made a really big deal about this in January, that he was pulling the state's money, a couple of billion dollars, out of investments with BlackRock, a company that is very much on the let's do the ESG thing. And the Orlando Sentinel got curious about, well, where did they put the money when they moved it, and discovered that four of the five investment firms that Patronis's office had moved that money over to also did ESG investing. Mm-hmm. So it was all just a big sham. And it just showed to me that, you know, all this concern about these three-letter boogeyman, it's a two-letter word. It's BS.
Yeah, yeah. Whether it's ESG, CRT, LGBTQ, you know, what you're talking about are creating these boogeymen and these cultural enemies to fight, because what this state and the governor and his acolytes are doing is running it into the ground on a practical level. When you look at the insurance rates, and when you look at the cost of living, and when you look at the water quality, every tangible measurement in this state is plummeting under the DeSantistan regime. But as long as they can continue to pull out culture war, woke enemies of goodness and righteousness and whiteness, they can get traction. And yeah, you know,
it's a distraction. It's simply a distraction, you know.
Yeah. And increasingly ESG, and I follow it a lot from the environmental standpoint, it makes sense to move away from dead technology, which is fossil fuel technology.
Yeah.
It makes financial sense to invest in solar, in wind, in technologies, you know, lithium batteries and electrical infrastructure upgrades to the power grid and things of that nature. You know, it was always okay for these investments to go to companies that supported fossil fuels, that supported whiteness and supported white nationalism, and were anti-woman and were anti-progress and were anti-wildlife. But as soon as the shoe is on the other foot, then it's not okay.
Yeah, well, and you know, and the fossil fuel industries, they're the ones that are pushing this whole anti-ESG thing.
Sure.
It's very clear that they're the ones, and then they dole out big campaign contributions.
Right. Because they've always been such huge benefactors of these municipal or state or pension fund investments, Exxon, Chevron, all of these BP, these big companies were always getting this money. And now that they see that the money is instead going to solar or wind program, they don't like that. So they're going to take it up with their Republican.
What is it? You call it the Grand Oil Party?
Yeah, the gas and oil party. They're going to go to their, you know, Republican politicians and say, stop this, stop this. And the best way that they've found to stop it is to make it part of the woke agenda, right? And anything that has an eye for the future or progress or equality is necessarily bad, because it's anti-white. It's anti-establishment. Yeah. It's anti the way it's always been done. FloridaPhoenix.com. You can learn more about ESG in Craig's latest article. We want to thank all the folks who have thus far signed up for the Welcome to Florida Patreon. Welcome to Florida is now offering you an opportunity to support our podcast and our efforts to continue bringing the show to you. $5 a month. That's all we're asking. 10, 20, 15, if you've got it, whatever it happens to be. Go to patreon.com/welcometoflorida. You can directly support Craig and my efforts to bring you this podcast every week. And once we hit 20 Patreons, and we're about halfway there, we will drop a special behind-the-scenes episode of Welcome to Florida and tell you all about how Craig and I got together and how we record the podcast. And we'll tell you how the sausage is made here every week on Welcome to Florida. Our guests this week both hail from Eatonville, Julian Johnson and John Beecham. A recent Florida Phoenix column by you, Craig, was focused on Eatonville, and that's kind of the genesis of this week's episode.
Yeah, yeah. I was writing about how folks in Eatonville are up in arms, and I can't say I blame them, because the school board took possession of what had been the Hungerford School property.
Now, this is the Orange County School Board, right?
The Orange County School Board, okay. Yes, had taken possession of this and now was selling it off piece by piece. And the biggest chunk now is going to go to a big developer that has lots of plans for the city that the city does not like. Mm-hmm. And so they're fighting back. And I interviewed the mayor and who has been pushing for Orange County to back off. And recently, the Orlando Sentinel had an excellent story. Desiree Stennett has been writing the heck out of these stories about how it turns out she found records showing Orange County actually illegally seized this property, that there were other claimants for it, including Mary McLeod Bethune. Was involved in trying to save the original school that was there, and they got basically brushed off. And a clearly racist Florida Supreme Court justice wrote the opinion that said, "Oh, it's none of this matters, and Orange County gets the property, and they can do with it what they want." So. It's just a fascinating situation. It really is.
Yeah. We've got two guests today. Julian Johnson is the owner of LVNU Financial Services. He grew up in Eatonville. He lives there now. He's the founder of 1887 First. I'll drop some links in the show notes for how you can follow Julian's organization. And John Beecham, also a longtime resident. He is a part of the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. You will hear them refer to PEC. That is PEC, the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community. John also runs the Eatonville 1887 History Tour. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. If you're in Eatonville right there near Orlando, you may be interested in taking that tour. I know I am very soon.
Most people don't know this, but Eatonville was the first incorporated blacks-only community in the United States, founded back in 1887.
We're going to start today in our conversation a backstory of Eatonville and its founding, and John gets us going.
Guys, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. I want to ask you, Eatonville is sort of, I want to call it a hidden treasure. It's a piece of remarkable, not just Florida history, but American history that I think a lot of people don't know about. How did Eatonville come to be?
Yeah, Eatonville started in the early 1800s. Where the former slaves moved to a place called Maitland, which was a settlement, and they lived around the lake called Lake Lily today. Then it was formerly known as St. John's Hole. And so that's where they gathered from Alabama, Florida, Georgia, and the Carolinas.
How many folks are we talking about?
At that time, probably a good couple hundred people.
That many? Wow.
Right.
How did they select that site?
Well, just like anybody, it was the central part of Maitland, and is where the industry was, and it was in a lake where in that area was owned by snowbirds or northerners, and so they allowed them to congregate there. And so it was almost like when people traveled, the word passed, kind of like the Underground Railroad. The information passed on. There's gold in them trees was the slogan. Oranges. And so they came down to this little place called Maitland, because again, Maitland wasn't a part of the traditional South like Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi. It was really just frontier.
And that, so there were citrus groves there that they could work at? Were there other?
Oh, yes. Yeah. That was the main goal, is to pick the citrus off the trees.
To what extent were they welcomed? You know, again, we're this is a, there are a lot of communities today where if a couple hundred African-American people showed up, they would not be well received. What was the reception for them at this time?
I think many of these people was Lincoln Republicans. So like, it was like, they wanted that, you know, you figure Lincoln freed the slaves, then assassination, Andrew Johnson rescinds his order. But so it was in a safe place. It was always surrounded by Northerners. So Maitland, Winter Park area, in this particular side of town that we live on, was always surrounded by Northerners. So they was welcomed by many, and probably disadvantaged by others. But however, in the beginning, got Joe Clark, which would be the founder of Edenville, became, there was black on the first Maitland City Council.
How did the city itself form? Or did they choose electors and incorporate, or how did that start?
Well, a guy named Lawrence Lewis came down. He was, again, another Lincoln Republican. He had tried an establishment in Utica, New York, where he had created a settlement for like Canadians. But he had restrictions and rules that they could not drink in his township. He was became a lumberman, so he had a lot of money. And so then they flunked the test because they wanted to drink. So he brought the Irishman in there. An Irishman, you know, the Irishman is going to flunk that test from day one. So when he moved to Florida and brought his sister's girl, there was a few whites in town, not a mass majority, that wanted the blacks to appear out of the ground in the daytime, but disappear like ghosts in the night. And he didn't think I was right. So he convinced a guy named Josiah Eden to sell him the land. And then he sold it to black at fair wages.
So he sold it to him. And then what happened?
Well, I think, I mean, he sold it to him, and then they built their settlement, didn't incorporate right away. But a few years later, he helped them to incorporate. And that's how they became the oldest black municipality in America. But it was a big controversy over helping them to incorporate, because the word around the world was, how can those Negroes self-govern themselves? Also, it was around the world where, like in the St. Louis Times and a lot of newspapers, that how can these Negroes self-govern themselves? They incorporated. And Lewis had to convince people that these people was different. They could keep clean streets and govern themselves in a proper manner.
Yeah. One of the great, if you call it a myth or just an overlooked reality, but there were so many thriving black communities around the country around the turn of the century. You know, we think about Tulsa and Black Wall Street. That's gotten a lot of attention recently, but so many places that you look, and there were communities that were thriving until Reconstruction fell apart, and then Jim Crow came back in, and racial terror, and all these race massacres, and they were increasingly black people disadvantaged from, you know, achieving in America, whether that was home ownership or business ownership. What was the Eden community like in these early, you know, decades, I guess, around the turn of the century?
Edenville has always been, again, surrounded by Northerners. So Edenville was in a position where there was always protection. You know, when they incorporated Edenville, they also, and sold the land to them, they put deed restrictions on those properties, you know, that you could only sell to another black. They just put a lot of protection in there. Edenville just was in the middle of Northerners. So Edenville was well kept in so many different ways. And also Maitland depended on that labor pool also to pick their citrus. Now, there's a place in town called Ocoee, which was a Ocoee massacre. Well, that was because Edenville, what happened in Edenville, they didn't want to help them across Central Florida, Orlando. So that's one of that was the motivation to stop Ocoee from incorporating like Edenville.
Wow.
But there was another place in town called Hannibal Square, which at the same time had the same option as Edenville, but they chose to go with the city of Winter Park and be a part of Winter Park. And that's the way fear plays in, because they felt like, and they had two aldermen on their council too, but it was like, but they decided not to incorporate.
Before we jump ahead to the present day, Edenville is probably best known for the home of Zora Neale Hurston. Give us the quick thumbnail sketch of Zora Neale Hurston's time in Eatonville and her connection to that place.
Well, we got to take it back first. I mean, that's what the outside world sees. Okay. But, you know, we had the first black Phantom of the Opera with Norm Lewis ever.
Oh, wow.
We have Deacon Jones that was, you know, the NFL great, you know.
Really? So,
which is even more powerful than Zora. Zora is a part of that culture, art, and history, but she's not the only voice. But, however, Zora is true to her roots and true to her culture heritage, because she didn't write for white people to read her books. She wrote it in dialect. She wrote it the way we speak, in hieroglyphics and in stories. So if you try to read one of Zora's books, it's really some of them could be a tough read. And I think that was her family claim. So she chose not to go just for money, but to give that experience of like living there, like in actuality. So Zora was definitely, you know, Zora didn't become famous until she died. That's when Zora really hit the marketplace. But before then, I mean, but it's good now to share that history with Zora. Zora was just no different than Julie and I. And, you know, she lived a life. She lived in Eatonville. Eatonville was one of those places where we didn't have, it was an all black township. So we didn't worry about the outside white community, because when we walked down the sidewalk in Eatonville, we knew who we was going to be facing, another black. We went in cow tongues. We speak boldly and courageously, because we never had that fear. But when you walked in Winter Park or Mississippi or around the world, when a white person came up, you had to go off the sidewalk. So I think when you see Zora, freedom of speech, and as I said, I think that's what you see that she gained from Eatonville, because she wasn't born there, but she lived there. Actually, one of my first cousins married one of her cousins. So,
oh, yeah.
So I think, you know, so there's more to Eatonville than Zora. We had a lot of great pioneers. My uncle, Burton Bellamy, actually made it to the Jet Magazine, the New York Times, because he invented this Model T Ford that would go around in circles to grind sugarcane. You know, so, and it made headlines. So there's a lot of inventors in Eatonville. But you don't, you know, when you're doing something that you always do, and when you're doing something that you know, to get by and make things work out, you don't consider that fame. You consider that just getting by.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, speaking of not just Zora, but all the other creative folks, I wonder if the security of being free of dealing with racism gave people time and energy that they could put towards those creative pursuits.
Well, I think that goes back to Lawrence and Joe Clark, the founder. And Joe Clark was the man. Yeah, because, you know, but like, as a child, so I'm speaking from a child perspective, and the eyes of the child is always different than a parent. Now, we heard about those stories. It was on the evening news. We knew the rules outside the walls. And they make my parents and our grandparents and siblings and cousins and Eatonville family, because we was all family, make sure we knew the rules outside the walls. So it's not like we knew what was happening, but just Eatonville, an everyday thing, was just a great experience, because it was like one big family.
Yeah. Yeah. Julian, you're a young man, younger than the other three of us on this conversation. What was it like for you growing up in Eatonville?
It was definitely family oriented when I was growing up. We were all playing outside. We were definitely, I think that was probably the early 2000s, you know, a more modern Eatonville. We had a community upbringing. So we had the recreation department. I think everything was pretty much operating. So we had the PEC, you know, they were doing their STEM programs and different programs, computer programs, the library. So growing up in Eatonville, we were all a family. We all played outside. We all were on our street, and everybody, you know, knew each other. You know, it was like a big family.
So when did you start to recognize that was not a common experience? Well, having a very close-knit community like that, playing outside, you know, sort of this idea that you are a community as opposed to just isolated families and individuals.
As we grew up, and I think it just goes from that saying, you know, or that song that they've been preaching for so long. You know, people told us to, you know, get out of here, go to college, get a good job, but they didn't ever say come back. and rebuild the community. They just say, mm-hmm. you know, get out, go to college, get a good job and get out. And I think once people just started growing up, everybody went their separate ways. And, you know, by the time we're all in probably high school, everybody went their separate ways and life just happened. And people went off to college, people, you know, some people passed away, some people. And I think once around high school, and that was probably like 2010, around that time frame, it started separating, that gap started separating there. And I think once that happened, you know, once our recreation department, once they got rid of that, it was just no more community involvement. Like the kids don't have much to do now. So back when I was growing up, there was always something to do for kids. Now it's totally different. There's nothing, you know, for them to do, especially outside of the weekdays. If they can't go to the Boys and Girls Club, they don't have anything to do. Not every kid is able to go to the Boys and Girls Club in Heaterville. So mm-hmm. they don't shoot every kid there, and there's nothing else for them to do outside of there. So, you know, when kids are bored, what is that called? You know, yeah. they're curious. It causes trouble. You know what I'm saying? So because they're bored.
Why did you decide to go back? You know, there's this idea of, you know, you go to college and go get a job and probably leave Eatonville in the rearview mirror. Why'd you go back?
I've always been different, kind of like the black sheep of the family. So for me, it was more so I saw the opportunity and the potential growth of being, you know, the first black municipality in the country. I took pride in that, and I looked at it as, okay, we may be going through a rough time right now, but there is opportunity and there is, you know, that light on the other side of the tunnel is near. We just need to spark it and get it back rolling, you know, until we're able to do that. I went back and got involved. I was actually out west in California. And when I realized, like, okay, I had everything here at home that I needed. So I came back, kind of regrouped, because I went out there for a business venture that kind of failed. And I had to come back and regather myself. That's how I got into the financial industry. And once I started understanding finances, that's when it all started clicking, because, okay, this is, you know, this is economics that we're dealing with. People losing their houses, you know, due to what is that, heirs property situations, parents or grandparents pass away. And they even lose their property. The heirs never were taught how to upkeep that property. They weren't taught to pay the taxes on it. Mm-hmm. So you have people coming, you know, preying on those situations. And that's kind of what happened. So for me, I learned the financial game. I learned how real estate works, you know, how these different things go on in the community and government. So now I was like, okay, well, we need to educate our community as a collective, all of the different organizations. What I saw in our community was disorganization, disunity. So I'm like, okay, well, let's work together and make this happen, which is why you all probably starting to see a lot of this stuff now, because we're all fighting together. And this is probably what our community needed.
Who lives in Eatonville now? And what do people do for a living generally?
My family lives there. Just your everyday people. Like, you know, there are people there in Eatonville who are everyday workers, and it's always been like that. I know our median or average income is extremely low in the area, but I think more so, you know, there is, it's like different type of, I guess, suburbs or different type of areas in Eatonville, where this street right here may have, you know, a upper middle class or a middle class environment. And then there are some areas where, you know, there may be a little rough around the edges, a lower income housing type situations. So it's more working class citizens and, you know, people who are trying to make a living. So Eatonville has a low crime rate.
Are there any particular major industries or businesses there?
Yeah, well, Tesla is in Eatonville. It's funny you say that. Tesla, Land Rover, what is that, Mini Cooper, they operate there. I think Maserati was there at one point, and Ferrari. There was a...
These are dealerships or what?
Yeah, dealerships, actually. Yeah. And they're actually in Eatonville. They're operating where the old Hungerford property, that was a piece of the property that was sold off by Orange County Public Schools.
Oh, so okay. I was going to get into that, but talk a little bit about the Hungerford property, about what it was.
started with 300 acres of land at first. And, you know, they had the school where they taught vocational, you know, agriculture, vocational, different things where people in the community could actually, you know, work, go to school and learn trades and skill sets that could earn them a living. And that's why it was different.
And it was a boarding school like the Tuskegee Institute, right?
Correct. Yeah. Directly modeled off of Tuskegee. Mm-hmm. And I think that was what made it intriguing, because there were kids that came from all over the state of Florida and, you know, even some in Georgia that went to Hungerford, and they came to that school just because it was a boarding school. But it was like the first black school for a kid, boarding school for kids in Central Florida at one point. I think it was more so of a way that we could actually, you know, economically help ourselves. But Orange County Public Schools didn't see it that way. They wanted it more for them, for themselves. So it was more of that Booker T model where he believes in self-governance, like, you know, in sustainability, than rather than the W.E.B. Du Bois, who believe in inclusion and, you know, kind of like the public school system.
John, let's bring you back in here and talk a little bit about the association to preserve the Eatonville community and organization you're a part of. That's sort of how we all got connected through Craig's recent article in the Florida Phoenix. Tell us about the association to preserve the Eatonville community and what that organization's aims are.
Well, I think they are a great part of our ecosystem. You know, they started out because Kennedy Boulevard was going to be four-laned, and it was already on the drawing board. Kelly had plans for it, and we stopped the PEC stopped it in 1983, I think. They stopped that road widening. They introduced Zora Neale Hurston Festival to Eatonville.
Oh, wow. And now because that's a big annual event there, right?
Yes, and PEC actually owns the right to Zora and her likeness. So the PEC is a I guess it would be the preservation is one of their things. PEC, you know, it's kind of like what we're doing as a community group, though. It's like the PEC is working with the Southern Poverty Law Group to make a lot of this stuff happen. But Julian and I and our land back committee group are doing the public awareness campaign, making sure everybody in Orlando knows what's going on, making sure to informing the people in Eatonville what's going on, and trying to get Eatonville and fans of Eatonville and bring it to the nation, the unjust economic injustice happened in Eatonville. But the PEC is a mainstay. I mean, PEC, Kwanzaa, they recognize Kwanzaa. They do educational forums with the Rollins College, relationship with Rollins College, relationship with UCF, Go Knight, Charge On. They're community activists. They're involved in every aspect of what happens in Orange County. But it's difficult for the PEC to exist monetarily at times, because so I have the opportunity to serve on many different board of directors, and I watch these other board of directors get money if sometime with just a handshake or sometime with a conversation. PEC has to go to the whole 9 yards, 20 yards to get their funding, and I think that's a form of discrimination. But most people will tell you, well, you know, you got to go through the process, you got to turn an application. So I think that's a relationship thing. So, but the PEC, if it wasn't for the PEC, I don't think I think we would still be talking. But I think the PEC does its job. And in this matter, this land matter, we call it the land back matter, we're doing our part. And as a board of directors, I helped endorse and sign off on having the Florida Southern Poverty Law Group represent us. But primarily, our executive director, Enwana Theory, operates that. And our board chair, Chad McKendry, are totally involved in that to the full extent. I don't want to get distracted and not make sure that we complete our mission. Our mission is basically land back and to make sure that we disrupt this injustice that's going on and bring it to the focal point.
So we're talking about the Hungerford property that Orange County Schools basically illegally seized back in the 50s, right?
Right. Right. We call it the land grab. And we're gonna get the land back. And but again, you know, from their perspective, you know, it's almost like, if I could be totally honest, it's like, you know, it's like your dad told you no, just because he said no, and that's no, and he doesn't realize that it was your brother that actually took the money out of his wallet, you know what I'm saying? But you're getting the punishment. And I think they're saying no but they see the facts that this land was taken. I can see how it was taken out of your hands. I looked at our county mayor as a black gentleman that can do a ton of good. I don't think it's a black, totally a black issue, but we had a black superintendent of school, Ron Blocker. We had Barbara Jenkins, and those people still remain neutral because of whatever ties and affiliation they have with our community. So Edenville is a, although Orlando is a, when you think about the mouse, you think about Universal, you know, it makes it seem like it's a big town, but we really are a small town. So in the three counties, Orange, Seminole, and Osceola, we all know each other. So it's not like living in the Bronx, you know, where, you know, or living in Manhattan, where, you know, you got your own separate little establishment. We're just one big community called Central Florida. And so we stand back and they're all standing back and watch this happen. Just because I, again, believe that because they have the power, Edenville government doesn't have the finance in their wallet to fight them. And so they're just basically been a bully.
I want to go back for a moment. And I looked at this, I didn't realize how close in Edenville was to Orlando. I mean, Edenville is essentially totally covered over by Orlando sprawl. And I thought it was a little further removed from that. I'm also noticing I-4 goes directly through Edenville. Was this, you know, is Edenville one of these countless American, African-American communities that urban renewal purposefully routed the interstate through to subdivide the community and you know, diminish the economic potential there?
Oh, no doubt. I mean, you don't need to probably answer that one. But yes, back in the day, when you stand on the hunger for property, you could see all those businesses that he discussed. You could see all the way back down to the whole 300 acres, pretty much. There was no interstate for it. But Orange County Public School Board profited off that I-4 interstate coming through there. I think a total of $6 million just for that portion of it. Wow. So they profited off all of that. All that land that those businesses that Julian talked about, it goes beyond that mile marker. And they've sold it off for the past 6-8 years, been selling off portion by portion, dictating our future, dictating all of this, and with Edenville not having a say. They don't have any, like, they really don't have to even tell us because they believe that they're the landowner. And that's where the whole systemic problem happens, because they have convinced town government that they are the actual landowner. But we believe, by doing our research, that we realize that we are, the land belongs to Edenville. And that last 100 acres where that school was, where school is located, was donated by Charles Hungerford and also town people. So they're just taking advantage of us because they have the power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When did I-4 get routed through the community?
Oh, God. It had to be like late
60s. No, it was 70.
70, well, like 60s, 70s.
Yeah.
It was exactly when they took those restrictions off the property in 74.
It didn't have to be educational anymore. It could be anything.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
It was already there. But yes, because my grandparents sold land so they can get some of the dirt to build that Interstate 4. But that still didn't stop Edenville from from growing. Edenville was always thriving. The biggest thing for Edenville is now that the school closed, because at some point, when the school closed completely down is when the hustle bustle started happening. It's like, what are you going to do with that land? Give us our land back. And that's when this whole fight started. Before then, Orange County Public School Board was going to court without opposition.
Julian, what is your 1887 First organization about?
So 1887 First, that was a brand I created where, you know, I felt like, okay, like I was saying earlier, we had a little bit of this organization, this unity. So I felt like we needed to create a new standard. So I created 1887 First, which means just what it says, 1887 First. We're going to operate with 1887, meaning the first established, you know, the date, the year of the date we established as the first municipality. Let's keep that in mind and operate with that in our mind first. So now we're thinking community first, in order for us to move the community forward. So, you know, for 1887 First, it was just more so a community organization to help bring organization back into our community. but also bring enlightenment to the financial aspect of things, the economics, and then more into understanding the needs of the people and what we need as a people currently right now so that we can fill in the gaps and voids with the current problems that we do have in our community. Because people, they kept telling us, oh, you guys, Eatonville needs this. Eatonville needs a tax base. It's always somebody on the outside telling us what we need. But there are other things that we need that aren't even getting met. Those needs aren't getting met. So like water issues or simple things like flooding issues. There's things that our government's not even meeting, but they're jumping over here saying like, oh, we need tax base because somebody did a study from who worked in Winter Park or something and told us this is what you guys need. But they don't even know what the people actually really need. So that's what we came in the fruition to bring, you know, to satisfy those current needs and fight for the people of our town.
If you're successful, if the Southern Poverty Law Center is successful with this lawsuit, where do you see Eatonville in, say, 10 years?
Oh, back thriving again, back to where where we had an economic. There was a point where Eatonville had an economic model. People used to come to Eatonville for if they wanted workers or people to do, you know, anything, any type of work, or they needed men, they would come to Eatonville. So I'm making building back our community up like that on an economic term to where people can actually that live in the town can actually go to work inside the town. They don't have to drive out, you know, an average of 27 to 28 minutes, because that's what the census says is the average work drive is 27 to 28 minutes for people that live in the town. Maybe we can come and work in our own town. We can come here and we can actually create that tax base through tourism, through different type of event centers, event space where people can come to the town, maybe even have a grocery store, now a gas station again, you know, these things so people don't have to leave the community to go and get the resources. They can just come and get them in their own community. So that's what my goal and hope is to see in the next 10 years. We're on the verge of doing that.
John, same question to you. What is your hope for the near future of Eatonville and that kind of 10-year time frame?
I'd like to see that us put our land the Hunger for Property into a land trust to create a village of destination built around culture, heritage, tourism, and the arts. We came up with a sketch based on what the people of Eatonville have said they wanted. Wyndham Worldwide that can do convention for more than 1,500 people, where we can take advantage of a tourism tax dollar. Where we, right now in Orlando, Central Florida, when there's a convention or a gala for more than 300 people, everyone, not just the people in Eatonville, has to drive to Shingle Creek, Disney, or Universal just to have some type of gala, create a recreational hub for our kids, a green park and space, create a main street such as Nashville or downtown Disney with chef-inspired restaurants. Please maybe talk to Blake Shelton and get a Big Red in here, a country bar, blues, jazz, and also shopping. And so, and then create an industrial hub where we already have this one commercial property that's going up on the Hungerford property. Create another a commercial zone of office space down by Westview News. Maybe some townhouses with people, grocery store, gas station. Those are everyday basic staple that people need, that they don't have to drive to do. And then so when people, and then an educational hub component where we can teach culinary skills, chef skills, we can teach our STEM research where adults can be educated and transfer themselves into those marketplaces that were just mentioned, working at supporting the hotels, driving their wages up from you know, $27,000 a year to maybe $60,000, $80,000, $100,000 a year, and creating those jobs that make people want to come back to the town or makes, and so not just for people in Eatonville, but for everybody in Orlando and around the world to come and enjoy this historical Black township and partner with Orange County in ways where the Zora Neale Hurston Museum. So every day we got tourism coming through our Eatonville that want to go to the Zora Museum. Every day we got people want to see where Deacon Jones played football or just to see this living museum. And I think like, so to coach Orange County and embracing it and investing in us so everybody in Orange County can enjoy this destination. That way we don't have to displace the people, because the development they're talking about when they come in and put condos, apartments, and all of these dwellings in, what it's going to do is force Eatonville to drive tax rate up, push the blacks out, mm-hmm. and because of the property taxes, and the apartments are $2,500, the houses are $600,000, certainly it's not going to be a place for Eatonville. We have great examples of that, like in Winter Park, the Hannibal Square, they just did a total push out of all the blacks and put the same type of dwelling in there, and there's the blacks are gone. Yeah. So what they created is segregation. It's not even gentrification, it's segregation. Huh. They also, downtown Orlando, we got a place called the Paramore District. They have pushed all of those blacks out of downtown Orlando to a place called Pine Hill, and the crime rate has gone crazy. And they want to deal with it with a criminal justice approach but what they did is when they pushed those people out, they gave them no economic hub out there. They didn't put a UPS plant. They didn't plan for an Amazon plant. They didn't plan like they're planning for like Nona industries out there so those people can work. So now the crime rate has gone crazy. They think the brothers are gone crazy. It's because it's their development and downtown, the power to be did that. And I think like as simple as it sounds, again, I'm a biblical guy. I think there's just need to be a repentance by our township and our law enforcement and our local government to apologize for that atrocity. And once we apologize that and the people accept the apology, we can grow as a large community. But if they do what they want to do in Eatonville is just going to be a place of markers. Oh, yeah, here's where Hunger Poppy used to be. Oh, yeah, this is the way Zora did her thing. And they think that's acceptable because then they charge us with their responsibility as like, what are you going to do with the property? Like the question you're asking us, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to do with it? I mean, what you're doing, it doesn't work. We have to come up with a drawing and they don't have to come up with a drawing. We have to answer the tough questions about our land and they don't have to answer those tough questions. We have a relationship with that land. My mother's sweat is on that land. My dad's sweat is on that land. My sweat is on that land from playing Eatonville football. My brothers, my grandparents, and other people in Eatonville parents on that land. We have a relationship as the indigenous people with their land. Eatonville has a profound relationship with that land. And in fact, if you think about what Lawrence did by putting those deed restrictions on there, just like your dad or any good father that has kids and he has accumulated a lot of wealth, he goes to his Merrill Lynch advisor and he takes care of them after his death. He takes care of them from the grave. And I think that's what Lawrence was doing. He knew one day that he would surely die because he was an elderly gentleman and he was trying to protect those blacks in Eatonville from his grave. And I feel like the ghost and the spirit of Lawrence Lewis, Joe Cyan, and Joe Clark is calling us today to make sure that we keep his restrictions intact. And that's what we're trying to do.
Wow. How optimistic are you that you will prevail in this lawsuit and your vision for Eatonville will be the one we see 10, 20, 25, 50 years from now, as opposed to the segregation by gentrification model that has happened elsewhere, not only in Orlando, but around the nation?
I'm 100%. This is where I get tricky for most people because I've received a vision from God and my job is not necessarily to, I know that we win and I don't want to take a sneak peek and get inside the books of the Southern Poverty Law Group because my job is to continue every day to tell the story. And so that's what God has given me, the vision to continue to tell the story about this town. And just like we tell a story every day about that baby that was born in a manger and died on the cross, and the third day rose again. I'm telling that story about this historical town of Eatonville. And I believe, and I've seen it, that we win. I don't know who that angel may be. The angel may be on your podcast and listen to your program, but there's an angel out there. Southern Poverty Law Group, I consider an angel. Julian, I consider an angel. I consider you guys are a part of that angel, the confirmation that God gives us that everything's going to be okay. So as a great poet, Tom Cruise said in that Top Gun movie, failure's not an option. It's not an option.
Hey, man, that'd be wonderful.
Yeah, we win.
Thanks, guys. Amen. This has been great. We really appreciate you coming on the podcast. Yeah.
Julian Johnson and John Beecham, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your insights into this community with us. And we are both solidly in your corner and have our fingers crossed for you.
Thank you very much. God bless, guys, and take care. Thank you so much.
Appreciate you all.
We close this episode of Welcome to Florida in unusual but exciting fashion. And it turns out John was right. The very next day after we recorded this episode, it was revealed that the development team that was set to close on the Hungerford property, that purchase of 100 acres of land in Eatonville, backed out of the sale. I'm reading from the Orlando Sentinel. In a victory for residents who felt the project planned for the former Hungerford site would have endangered the historic Black Town's legacy, the sale's unraveling comes amid escalating pressure from Eatonville residents led by the Association to Preserve the Eatonville Community, which filed suit against property owner Orange County Public Schools to block the sale last week with the help of the Southern Poverty Law Center. So congratulations to the Eatonville residents, the community activists and organizers, to John, Julian, and everyone there who for now has saved the Hungerford property, that 100 acres, and the Eatonville community. What is next is not known at this point, but the development that they were fighting has been defeated. Welcome to Florida.